thank you, Henick, for the very generous introduction. And I also must say that it is truly an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've known Fred Jelinek since the early 1980s. I have a huge amount of respect for him, his vision, his technical capabilities, his leadership. He's done phenomenal things for IBM, for Johns Hopkins, and for the speech community at large. I don't want to minimize any impact that Fred has had on all of us here. We are his children and grandchildren intellectually. I'm not very used to these things. You got to hold them frontward to get the full effect. As you heard from Henick, I was, in fact, originally trained in auditory perception. My original work was in binaural hearing. And indeed, over the last 20 to 25 years, I've been spending the bulk of my time trying to figure out how we can improve the accuracy of speech recognition in difficult acoustical environments. And by speech recognition, I also mean the associated speech technologies, speaker identification, verification, language ID, and so forth and so on. In this talk, I'd like to talk about some of the things that I've been doing along with some of my students and colleagues recently. Recently is relative, but in trying to apply knowledge of auditory perception to improve ASR accuracy. And as I'll certainly be very careful to state, I didn't invent this approach. People had been doing it long before I was even in speech recognition, but it's once again back in the forefront, and so I thought it was a good time to talk about it. And kind of the things that I'll talk about will be more or less faithful to physiology and psychophysics. I used to say that when I go to ASA meetings, the hearing research community is primarily concerned with, shall we say, fundamental understanding of how audition works. In speech recognition, we're indeed quite focused on the bottom line, the error rate. And I'm more than willing, when I'm wearing my engineering hat, to sacrifice any scientific principles if I can get some insight that'll improve recognition accuracy. But nevertheless, being mindful of what goes on in the auditory system, I think, can help. So some of the big questions that we can think about are how can or to what extent can knowledge of auditory physiology and perception improve recognition accuracy or other figures of merit in speech recognition and related topics? Can speech recognition results tell us anything we don't already know about auditory processing? I'm not so sure about that, but there are a few things that are interesting that we see. In particular, what aspect of this kind of processing is most valuable, or what aspects are most valuable for robust feature extractions? So I do want to put this in the context of two discussions, one new and one old. And the first one is that, as you've heard from Rick Rose and other speakers, everything is changing right now. And I actually had the misfortune to miss the big speech meetings, ICASP and InterSpeech, for the last three of the cycles, one for a health problem, one for a death in the family, and one for a schedule conflict. So I've kind of run through all the excuses. I'm going to have to start recycling them. But I do expect to be at InterSpeech 2014. But of course, when everybody, I always ask the people who go when they come back what they hear. And the extreme formulation of what I hear is that, well, you ought to just retire now because all the stuff that you've done in the last 20 or 30 years isn't useful anymore. We'll just put everything in a big neural net, and it doesn't matter what comes out the other end. The neural net will figure it all out. So work on robustness is obsolete. Work on auditory processing is meaningless, at least in this context. It was scary. It still is scary. I don't really know where the ground truth is on that. But I still do believe that certainly we've seen dramatic improvements when you have matched training conditions and lots of data and lots of processing power. When you have mismatched conditions, less processing power, change in tasks, especially small tasks, I think the book is still out. And if I manage to talk fast enough, I'll be able to comment on that at the end. I'm not serious about that. I'll talk fast enough regardless of what happens. In any case, so fields are changing rapidly, and things that I say today in terms of what's useful may not be as useful tomorrow. My hope certainly is that it's not totally useless, but as the Chinese used to say, we are living in interesting times. The other one is an old discussion, which is knowledge-based versus statistically-based signal processing or speech recognition. This shows up, for example, going back to the 1970s, we had the two great systems from Carnegie Mellon, Harpy and Hearsay. And Hearsay was a computer scientist dream. It did everything the right way. From the standpoint of AI, there was something that hypothesized phonemes, something that hypothesized words, sentences, pragmatics, and text, a big blackboard to put things on and run hypotheses by. And it did pretty well. And then there was the Harpy system, which basically was an early proto-hidden Markov model, although people didn't think of it that way and the models weren't as hidden. But it was a statistically based approach using embedded networks that Jim Baker developed, although it was actually based on Bruce Lowry's thesis, and his name is most associated with it. So it was far less interesting to the computer scientists, but in fact it worked a little bit better. And this was the kind of seedling for a big argument that took place in the early 1980s. Carnegie Mellon, I'm happy to say, was on the we were the main advocates for what I regard as one of the biggest scientific failures that I've ever been associated with, the Angel system. Some of you may remember that. Martha perhaps might. Jack certainly would. In any case, we developed, and I was part of that along with several colleagues, a system trying to use human knowledge principles to build a system based using expert knowledge. And certainly the problem that we found was that there's just too damn much knowledge or data to try to record manually. But suffice it to say that we got overrun by hidden Markov models. First BBN developed speaker-dependent models, and fortunately for us, Kai-Fu Lee came along at just the right time to demonstrate speaker-independent hidden Markov modeling, and that technology was the genesis for many things that followed, although once again, the run of the HMM is nearing an inflection point at the moment, and we'll see what happens over the next 5 years. It will be interesting. In any case, I look on work on things like auditory modeling and specific conditioning as the way we put in knowledge in the 21st century. We have statistically based systems to make the most of what we have, but I do believe that it's always helpful to frame our problem the right way, to put all the structure that we can into a problem so that we can make it as easy as possible for those classifiers. The cleaner the representation, the easier it is to train the system, and in fact, at the end of the day, the more likely that things will come out the way we want them. So what I'll do today is start by reviewing some of the major physiological and psychophysical results that motivate the models. What Hynek failed to mention in his introduction is most of the real work that I did in binaural hearing was 20 and 30 years ago, and I'm just kind of coasting on my reputation. Fortunately, I have a lot of friends who keep promoting me on the hearing side. But so this will be old stuff, and I apologize for many of you who already know this stuff. It's pretty basic. But I thought in the spirit of bringing both the new speech experts and as well as our friends, the language experts, these are the terms I've been trained to use, along, I will repeat some things, and I apologize in advance if the repetition is unnecessary for at least some of you. Then I'll talk about some of the major classical auditory models of the 1980s, and specifically models by Stephanie Seneff, Dick Lyon, and Oded Gitze. Those are prominent partly because Stephanie Seneff, A, was at MIT, which always attracts attention, and B, gives her code away, which is always a good idea. So, lesson for all of us. Dick Lyon was, along with Malcolm Slaney, the co-author of the Auditory Toolbox, which featured at least the first two models. And Oded Gitze had a widely circulated contemporary model that the Bell Labs people used. I'll review some of the major new trends in today's models, and finally, in the last third or so, I'll talk about some representative issues that have driven some of our work lately at Carnegie Mellon and what we've learned from them in that regard. So, this is a real basic slide. This is in the interests of making things trivial for everybody. Speech recognition is like any pattern classification problem. You start with something physical, in this case air pressure, that changes over time. And then you extract a series of features, numbers, which we call features, that hopefully convey some meaning about what it is that we're interested in this case recognizing the speech. And finally, you put those numbers in a black box, and the black box, the decision maker, compares those numbers to a bunch of other representative numbers that it has and decides what the closest match might be. So today, I'm only going to talk about stuff that happens between here and here. So this is about as far at the opposite end of the food chain as you can get for those of us who are language experts. This is at the other end, the input end, the raw transformation from the acoustic pressure signal into the numbers that those HMMs or DNNs or what have you actually use. And obviously the choice of features is important. Now, I should say that the default signal processing used is something called malfrequency Kepstle coefficients. I'm not going to elaborate on that for now, but basically what happens is you have the speech coming in, you multiply it by a brief temporal window, somewhere between roughly 20 to 30 milliseconds is popular. These were all numbers were chosen based on boring, exhaustive experiments conducted in the 1980s, which may not be valid, but too much to revisit. Then you take a Fourier transform, so you get a short-time Fourier transform out of that. Then there is triangular weighting of the magnitude spectrum to give you a representation of energy in different frequency bands. The frequency bands happen to get wider as we go up in frequency for reasons I'll discuss later. And then you take the log of that, and then the inverse Fourier transform of that, and you get a bunch of numbers, typically 13 or 12, that are, for mathematical reasons, relatively Gaussian and relatively independent of one another, and that makes things good for the classifiers. That's within that broad description, there are a lot of variations, but that's as deep as I'd like to go on that for now. Today is going to be a no equation day, or a low equation day. Now, this is an example of a spectrogram. You'll recognize it as a MATLAB spectrogram. And those of you who have taken Victor Zhu's course over the years will recognize instantly that that's me saying, welcome to DSP-1. So here's the welcome to DSP-1. How many of you took that course? Raise your hands. Nobody. All right, so you have no idea what I'm talking about. All right, doesn't matter. Time is going this way, frequency is going this way. As we go from blue to red, you get concentrations of energy within those particular frequency bands. Now, over here is the actual spectrum that's recovered by malfrequency Kepstle coefficients. I just took the actual MFCCs from the standard Sphinx front end, reconverted them back to spectrum, and plotted them on the same display. Now, you take a look at them, and they're blurry. In fact, even with my glasses off, that still looks blurrier than that one. In all fairness, that's a little bit of a misleading comparison, because some of the things that were done in creating this representation were to deliberately make it blurry. It was felt at the time, for example, that these horizontal striations, which represent fundamental frequency, were regarded as irrelevant at best and distracting at worst and should be removed. So that causes some of the blurriness, but you're really losing a lot of information. And the question that gets raised is, can't we do better than that? And of course, there have been a lot of putative answers to that over the years. So yeah, it's blurry. And although we haven't talked about it yet, aspects of auditory processing that are represented include frequency selectivity and spectral bandwidth, nonlinear amplitude response, but there's a lot of stuff that isn't in there. Detailed timing structure, lateral suppression, enhancement of temporal contrast, other auditory nonlinearities. Maybe I shouldn't say that yet, but we haven't talked about any of that, but just keep that in mind for now. Okay, so let's talk about the ears for a moment. This is your standard Gray's Anatomy before the TV show, image of what the ear looks like. This is the outer ear of the pinna. Air pressure comes in here. This is the tympanic membrane or eardrum. As tiny changes of pressure happen here, this moves in and out. That moves the three bones in the ear, the hammer, anvil, stirrup, or as the otolaryngologists like to say, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. That basically is an attempt to get an impedance transformation, a mechanical impedance transformation, to this structure here. This is the stirrup, which actually looks a little like a stirrup. And this is the cochlea. And for the next stage of the cochlea, I'd like to go to an animation by Jim Hudspeth and Howard Hughes. I think some of you have seen this, but it's a cool animation, so I couldn't resist showing it at this point. And this shows the inner workings of the cochlea. Let's see. Ah, no. Oh, yeah, I know. I got to do this by hand. All of you who have given presentations know that there are two ways of having the cursor. One way you can see it here, and the other way you can't. And right now it's in the can't mode. Now it's in can't see it anywhere mode. It goes on from there, but you got the idea. So you have a mechanical pitch-to-place transformation as you move along that basilar membrane. And along the basilar membrane, the structure itself is innervated by about 30,000 fibers of the auditory nerve. They have their little, little connectors, dendrites, actually on the membrane. And as the membrane moves in a small localized area, the hair cells will move along with it. That will elicit changes in the ions as moving in and out of the walls. I took this course a long time ago and haven't kept up. But in any case, that elicits spikes going down first the auditory nerve and then up the various pathways in the brainstem. So here we have a representation of the central auditory pathway. And it's quite complicated. This was there are lots of these things on the web now, and this is about the simplest and most colorful. You can make it much more spaghetti-like. And I'm only going to talk about the response right here, right at the beginning. This is the cochlea, and this is here. It's in series with everything else. So anything that happens at that point goes on here. There is some interesting discussion about stuff that's going on at a higher level. Those of you familiar with spectral, temporal, receptive fields, or response fields, I always forget, speaks to recent and less recent physiological work up there. But I'm going to defer that for now because it doesn't play a direct role in things that I'll be talking about today. So, the standard experiment of the mid-60s and the MIT lab led by Nelson Kang was one of the most active groups of the time. There were people in Wisconsin and, for that matter, everywhere else. But these data are from the MIT group. And what we're looking at is a response, post-stimulus time histogram, PST histogram, which you would get if you would stick an electrode into, or actually not into, but rather very close to, one of the fibers of the auditory nerve. This is the standard experiment that was done, typically on cats. And if you do this, signal will be cruising along in a few negative tens of millivolts, and then would suddenly go down like that, and then come back up, go down like that, and come back up. And the basic dogma was that what mattered was the times at which these spikes occurred. And this is a histogram of over many trials of a tone burst that begins here and ends here. And what you can see happens is that there's an overshoot, a burst. The overall number of spikes per second goes from about 20 or so in spontaneous rate up to about 150 and kind of settles around here. And then when the tone turns off, there also is a temporary deficit of activity. So it goes down, undershoots, then comes back up to baseline again. So we can think of this as an enhancement of temporal contrast of the signal that comes in, at least to the extent that that is representative. This is a classic experiment. And what the experiment is that you, again, take a probe at a given nerve fiber, play a tone through it, through the cat's ear, and then look for the intensity at each frequency that is necessary to elicit a percentage increase in the number of spikes above threshold. This is a threshold increase. And for a given fiber, you get a curve that looks like this. So what this tells us is that each fiber is maximally sensitive at different frequencies. This is so-called best frequency, characteristic frequency. The frequencies are, it looks like the bandwidths of these filters are roughly constant, but because of the fact that this is a log scale, at least at high frequencies, it reflects the fact that it's really a constant Q system. The bandwidth is proportional to the center frequency. And at low frequencies, it appears that they're getting broader, but again, that's illusory, but it's because, again, a log scale gets really broad at low frequencies. And what's actually happening is they're roughly constant at low frequencies. So these channels, if you want to think of them that, and they're pretty nonlinear, they're obviously asymmetric, but nevertheless, they're frequency-sensitive channels. Each has this particular frequency response. The best frequencies are distributed roughly uniformly with respect to log frequency between about 20 and 20 kilohertz. This is prototype. This is this curve, by the way, was from the Wisconsin group. I forget exactly where. I stole them mostly from Brian Moore's book and Pickle's book in auditory psychology and physiology. This is a curve by Murray Sachs and Abbas, one of his former students. This is rate as a function of intensity. And the interesting thing here is that it's an S-shaped curve. Again, this is intensity in dB, so it's a log scale. It's constant, and I should say that the spontaneous rate was subtracted off in each of these curves. There always is a spontaneous rate when you're doing nothing. You still get some activity. So it starts here. It's linear for a while, and then it saturates. Linear for a while, and then saturates. This one hasn't saturated yet, but it will. And the dynamic range for most of these things is only about 20 dB, 20 to 30 dB. So one of the kind of long-term mysteries of hearing science, which again still doesn't have a complete explanation, is how do you code loudness over such a wide range of intensities unambiguously when each individual fiber goes? And the answers all have to do with spread of excitation over a range of characteristic frequencies. The thresholds themselves have a distribution of around 20 dB, so there are a lot of discussions about that, which I won't go into. Next, when we have a tone above threshold, what we're looking at now is a post-zero crossing histogram, so which tells us effectively the relative likelihood of observing a firing a certain number of degrees in phase after a positive zero crossing. And what we see is that as we go from low intensities up to higher intensities, not only does the number of spikes increase from about 20 to about 200, that I didn't press in the, from about 50 to about 200 roughly, but also we get phase locking. This phase locking enables us to, we get cycle by cycle synchrony with respect to the signal coming in. Now, this kind of stuff is obviously important at, and I should also say that this goes away at high frequencies, and it certainly is believed to be important for auditory localization. I say this as a binaural hearing guy. If you have a signal coming in there, from there it's going to hit this ear sooner than this ear, and at low frequencies at least, the auditory system can do a cross-correlation, and from that infer the relative time delay, and from that infer the direction of arrival. And that is believed to be the dominant mechanism for localization at low frequencies. At high frequencies, that becomes useless because you get spatial aliasing, and the delay becomes more than half a period. coincidentally, our ability to follow the synchrony like that disappears. We only observe that phenomena by inference up to a certain frequency, and that frequency depends on head size, and the smaller the head, the higher the frequency at which you lose it. So it's just by species, anatomical species comparison, it's widely believed to be there. Nevertheless, it's clearly important for auditory localization, but it could also be important for monaural processing of complex signals as well. And in fact, that's part of a number of models of hearing based on physiological processing. The next thing I'd like to talk about is lateral suppression and auditory processing. This work was done by Murray Sachs. Some of you may know Murray. I think he's retired now, at Johns Hopkins. He was the thesis advisor of Eric Young, who more of you probably know. This is from his own doctoral thesis in 1968 with Nelson King. And what we're looking at here is a typical tuning curve for this frequency response curve for a single auditory nerve fiber. And now the experiment is that the tone is presented 10 dB above threshold for this particular fiber at the best frequency response, and then a second tone is added. And it's observed that the presence of the second tone at adjacent frequencies inhibits the overall response to the signal to the two-tone signal, overall response to the two tones. And this shaded area on this side and this side indicates the combinations of frequencies and intensities for which we observe this so-called lateral suppression. Now, the interesting thing about this is the suppression will take place at intensities and frequencies by which, if that suppressor tone were presented by itself, you wouldn't see any response to it at all. It's below threshold. It's outside the original tuning curve. But nevertheless, we have this effect that signals at some frequencies will suppress signals at adjacent frequencies. Now, the practical consequence of this would be that we get enhancement of change an enhancement of gradients of change. So there's enhancement of contrast. Some of you may who work in vision are familiar with Mach bands. If you have a bright field and a dark field next to each other, at the very edge, the bright part is brighter and the dark part is darker. And this is effectively an auditory equivalent of that. You can get enhancement of spectral contrast. At least that could happen. There are various ways of measuring psychophysical counterparts of these, and in the interest of brevity, I'm not going to say any details, but if any of you are curious, I'd be happy to talk more about all of this. But there have been gobs of measurements made on estimating the bandwidth of these auditory channels. In fact, the original ones were by Harvey Fletcher and Munson, his colleague at Bell Labs in the early 1920s. They were interested in, you know, what's important for understanding signals over telephone lines. And these are a composite of work that was done in the 80s and 90s. And what we're looking at here is measurements of the so-called critical bandwidth, which is, you can think of this as the width of these auditory filters, estimated perceptually, estimated psychophysically, as a function of their central frequency. And once again, the width of the channels, and the width and frequency of the channels by which we're presumed to process sounds, gets larger as the center frequency gets larger. This is a function of center frequency. This is the fact that this is linear indicates that, again, we have a constant Q filter bank. Bandwidth is proportional to center frequency. Things bend in different ways depending on how you measure it, so they become more like constant filters. Now, these observations gave rise to at least three different frequency scales that have been widely used over the years. You could think of this as the German one, the American one, and the British one. But the first one is the Bark scale, which was named after Barkhausen. I only discovered this recently. Especially Zwicker was a big proponent of this. It's basically a formula that characterizes how the bandwidth of the units vary. The MEL scale was proposed by Smitty Stevens, who was S.S. Stevens, psychophysicist at Harvard for many years. I just missed him. And I actually thought for years that MEL was called that because of some guy named MEL. Finally, after a very long time, I actually read the paper in the 1938 JASA that I'd been citing for decades. And sure enough, it wasn't MEL at all. It was MEL is short for melody. These estimates were based on pitch. In fact, it was interesting that three different psychophysical methods were used to derive these. The ERB was done by Brian Moore, who appears to write a paper about every month in JASA. He has to have a H index of 5,000 by now, very prolific, very, very talented guy, equivalent rectangular bandwidth scale from Cambridge, and his formula looks like that. And the reason why I say this is that basically all auditory models start with something that has some kind of reflection of the fact that the analysis bandwidth gets wider at high frequencies than it does at low frequencies. Why might this be a good idea? Well, at low frequencies, and this is a hypothesis that Campbell Searle proposed quite a while ago, at low frequencies it's useful to have narrow bandwidth so you can distinguish between vowels, which you can get fine analysis. At the higher frequencies, presumably, the only stuff that's up at the higher frequencies are those big plosive bursts, and we don't need a lot of fine frequency analysis, but the greater bandwidth gives us an opportunity to have greater temporal resolution. That in principle would give us an opportunity to do a better job in discriminating consonants based on the high frequency channels. Of course, we throw all that away by continuing to use 20 millisecond analysis windows. But if we do things like the wavelet people would suggest, as we get broader in bandwidth, we get sharper in time, maybe that would give an improvement. I've tried that, by the way. It didn't help me at all, but it's been suggested. It hasn't helped Les Atlas either. In any case, if you take these three frequency scales and normalize them, which I did just simply scale them, and they're all pretty similar. So the bottom line is it doesn't really matter which one of them you use. They basically get you to the same place. It's just that you do want to have narrow frequency analysis at low frequencies and broader frequency at higher frequencies. A couple of other phenomena, and then we'll move on to some real results, since I've already chewed up 31 minutes of my nominal 50 to 60. A couple of other things that are going on. Perceptual masking of adjacent spectral temporal components. If you imagine a spectrogram, real intense signals at a given frequency will mask adjacent frequencies, and asymmetrically, low frequencies tend to mask high frequencies more effectively than high frequencies mask low frequencies. There's a reason for that based on both the mechanics of the cochlea and the asymmetry, which are reflected in the asymmetries that we already observed in the tuning curves. And the asymmetries in the masking go the way you would expect they would. Temporal masking also, a loud sound can suppress your response for things later, and also a little surprisingly before as well. It's because there's some interference, some storage backlog. And both of these phenomena are an important part of the auditory models that were used in perceptual audio coding, such as in creating MP3 files. Many of you who play MP3 files probably have no idea how they got so thin, but basically there's an auditory model in there that tries to figure out how much they can get away with not preserving what's going on at certain frequency bands, because those spectral temporal components are already masked by other stuff that's in the program. So the model tries to predict that, and then they code those parts very crudely, and then they pay more attention, and by doing so you save bandwidth. The last one is loudness of sounds. Again, a product of Fletcher and Munson from Bell Labs. This is threshold of hearing curve, this is threshold of pain curve, and then in between everything is kind of compressed. And this is also an important part of a number of auditory models. In summary, some of the things that, I'm citing these phenomena selectively because these are the ones that kind of show up a lot in auditory models and seem to be helpful. Some of the phenomena that are included include frequency analysis in parallel channels, that's pretty basic. Preservation of temporal fine structure, at least at low frequencies, may be helpful. Limited dynamic range in individual channels, definitely true in real life. part of some models, not all. Enhancement of temporal contrast at onsets and offsets, yes, important. Enhancement of spectral contrast, very rarely included, but certainly happens in real life. And most of these physiological attributes of psychophysical correlates, and most of them are not preserved in MFCC representations. Some are, but most aren't. So that's the starting point, or maybe the midpoint, for this discussion. So as I said, there was a fair amount of activity in this in the 1980s. One of them, which got a wide release, was the Seneff model. This was part of Stephanie Seneff's doctoral thesis, which was, I forget the exact date, but it was in the, it was out by the early 80s. And she would have a critical band filter bank, a hair cell model, which I'll say a bit more about later on, which modeled the transduction from the pressure nominally in the basal membrane to the emergence of the nerve pulses. And then there would be two things coming out. There'd be an envelope detector, which would give you basically a measure of average energy coming out in each channel after the nerve model, and a so-called synchrony detector. She had something called a GSD, or generalized synchrony detector, that would actually give you a measure of phase locking at that frequency of interest, kind of like an autocorrelation function at the lag that's the reciprocal of the characteristic frequency. If we take a look at this in more detail, there's a saturating half-wave rectifier, which is part of pretty much everybody's model, a short-term AGC, which should have, if the time constants are right, has the effect of doing some temporal contrast enhancement, a low-pass filter, which gives you envelope extraction at high frequencies, if the constants are right, and again a rapid AGC, which will also give you enhancement of temporal contrast. And again, she probably gets more play than she should, but she gets it because she gave away the code and a lot of people analyzed it. So if you want people to pay attention to, give away your stuff. You'll get lots of citations. May not make a lot of money, but you'll be famous. So that was used to extract synchrony, and she would show diagrams of spectrograms based on the mean rate spectrum and the synchrony spectrum, and they were pretty interesting. Another one was Oded Gitz's EIH model. EIH stands for, say it again? Thank you. Envelope interval histogram. Yes. So you have the various channels, and they're level crossings, and then interval histograms. And level crossings all have different thresholds. So it gives you an ensemble of, that's the E, of the interval histograms. And that would give you, in the end, something that looks like a histogram that could look like an autocorrelation function. So you'd have your temporal information in there. And then that was used as the, I think they would just add it together and that would be the representation. This is, again, just a given channel. The third one was Dick Lyon's model. Dick is, during the time I knew him, he was at Fairchild, then he was at Apple, then he was at Interval, then he was at IBM for a while, and now he's at Google. But now he's at Yahoo, and now he's at Google. Fovian. Man, I missed that. He was a student of Carver Mead, so that's not unexpected. And that would make him a, intellectual cousin of Lloyd Watts. Anyway, so this is a single stage of the model. This was presented in the 1982 ICASP. The one thing I'm going to say, a lot of these become repetitive, but he also included nonlinear compression and also lateral suppression and temporal effects. This is the only model of the ones I've discussed so far that really went out and deliberately included lateral suppression, which many of us think is important. And he also proposed a so-called correlogram, which I have to say at the autocorrelation level is not terrifically well supported by physiology. There's a lot of evidence for cross-correlation, much less evidence for autocorrelation. At least this is 20 years ago, that might have changed now. But in any case, that's another useful way. It's basically the autocorrelation of each of the channel outputs, and that also was an interesting display. While we're here, let's talk about one more. This is the Cohen model, not nearly as infamous. Next time around, you'll give your code away. or have Lion integrated into the auditory tools. But it certainly is every bit as worthy of mention along with the rest. It's contemporaneous, 1989. You made it into the 80s, but only barely. And critical band filters, two features that you don't see elsewhere. There's a fairly careful loudness normalization, and you can perhaps tell us how important that is at some point, but which is actually pretty unique to this model. And, almost, there's another one that I'll talk about that does that as well. Power law compression, and also short-term adaptation. The short-term adaptation, which was very elaborately discussed, is basically an implementation that gives you something that looks like the post-stimulus histograms of the first slide that I showed. In fact, I believe that you took yours from the same figure. I didn't have that in there because of your paper, but when I reread the paper, it looked like very familiar. In any case, so that had all the right stuff. It didn't get as much play, I think partly because Jordy was working in an obscure place in a small, town in Upper Westchester and for a big computer company. But it was, I believe, used fairly successfully as the IBM front end for quite a while. Yeah, it was used for 10 years. So the Tangora system? Yeah. Under the supervision of Fred Jelinek and Bob Mercer.
I believe it was the first hardware model that ever made speech recognition.
Ah. Larry Rabiner would wax very rhapsodically about Odid Gitz's work. And he said that it would make it better too, but they did not use it because of the computation. And while I'm here, I should make mention of one other approach, which is the other standard approach to feature extraction. Perceptual linear prediction, PLP. He and Kermansky published the paper in 1990, but he's got to be working on it in the 1980s. Right? In fact, it was submitted in 1989, so I'll include this as work in the 80s. And I look on this as a pragmatic approach to auditory modeling, and if you look at the basic blocks of PLP, and this is a diagram that I did years ago, there's a DFT, again, weighting by frequency, although it's a little bit different. You can involve the input display with frequency-varying filters. Loudness normalization. And then there's a cube root compression, which is also part of the Cohen model, and then an all-pole model. So except for the, there's not a deliberate contrast enhancement that I noticed, although it does come later with Rasta. Yeah, with Rasta. Yeah, we'll get to that. At this level, it still had almost all the same elements as the Cohen model, which were developed relatively independently. You did? Okay. But did you influence each other? Or is it just parallel development? In any case, this provides a lot of that, and I'm going to come back to PLP later, but I think that we should definitely, it would be unfair to Hynek to not mention this in the same context as everything else, but Hynek was particularly concerned with having something that was workable and computationally efficient. And of course, it is widely used. I would guess that there are at least as many people using PLP today as there are using MLCAPs. And it's pretty much 50-50 in the speech research community. Now, nevertheless, the auditory models per se didn't get a lot of play in the 80s. And a very good reason for that was that they were slow. They were real slow. In fact, if you read all the papers, almost without exception, they would be very long on displays for how great these things were, and very short on speech recognition results. And when there were results at all, they would be for kind of trivial tasks. Some of you may argue with that, but I had a student, Yoshiaki Oshima, in the early 1990s. One of the things we did, again, because we had the code, is we counted the multiplies. And these are the multiplies incurred in the Senef model. And this is the number of multiplies incurred in linear prediction in coefficients. And malfrequency Kepler coefficients and PLP coefficients about the same computational load. So it was a factor of about 800 to 1200 to 1 in terms of speed, throwage, awayage, depending on how you countered. And unless you got some clear benefit from that, nobody's going to do it. So I should say that the models in the 80s included realistic filtering, realistic auditory nonlinearity. People paid attention to those things in those days. In some cases, synchrony extraction, in one case, lateral suppression. Lyon also proposed higher order processing through water correlation and cross correlation, which I won't have time to get into right now. The main thing that always amused me was that every system developer had his or her own idea of what was the most important thing. And of course, that continues to this day, and of course, that's normal. We found in Akio Shima's thesis that, again, not much quantitative evaluation was actually performed. We found in general that the physiological processing didn't help much at all for clean speech, which is one reason why it was another reason why it wasn't adopted. It didn't make it better, but it did make things more robust for to degraded input. If you added noise, if you added reverb, it would help. But for clean speech, typically no. However, the benefits that we generally would get would be achieved with much more prosaic approaches, not based on auditory processing. I had Alex Athero's algorithm, codeword dependent Kepstle normalization, VTS by Pedro Moreno and Bhikshal Raj. They both gave us the same benefits, at least for noise. And to some degree for reverb, but not so much, with at a fraction of the cost, as they say on late night TV. And so you couldn't argue auditory models based on the value proposition. Other things that were issues in the 1980s was that there wasn't a good statistical match between the characteristics, the features, and the speech recognition system. We forget this, but in those days, we were doing recognition using either, either dynamic time warping or, discrete HMMs, where we were always working with Gaussians, single univariate Gaussians. People didn't get down the technique for estimating the statistics of mixture densities, which changed everything with continuous HMMs. But before we had continuous HMMs, the density shape mattered, and the auditory models did not give you Gaussian outputs, and that degraded performance. In fact, an interesting study that nobody really remembers, again, Ben Shigi and some other colleagues at 9X, did an experiment with Senef's model versus conventional processing for regular HMMs and for neural networks. And the performance for the auditory models was much better for the neural networks, because in those days, the neural networks, as they always can model the densities, the distributions, in ways that the HMMs of the early 1980s did not do. So, again, this became a non-issue with the subsequent development of continuous HMMs using Gaussian mixtures as the model, which is the current technology. And basically, the signal processing wasn't a limiting factor. In those days, we in the community didn't know how to do anything. So, there wasn't much going on. So, in the 1990s, things started to change. By the late 1990s, physiologically motivated, perceptually motivated approaches began to flourish, it's fair to say. Some of the major new trends were, again, we didn't care about computation anymore. We had much bigger computers. And in any case, feature extraction was nothing compared to the cost of doing the search. So this was kind of a non-issue at some point. Serious attention started being paid to temporal evolution, not just looking frame by frame, but looking at how things evolved over frames. This shows up in modulation spectrum and FD frequency-dependent linear prediction, FDLP, just as I was starting to say. TRAPS was an early, very important, indication that by looking at how things go across time, we can win. And also, it became apparent that even in trivial environments, that we shouldn't be just thinking about noise. Reverb is also a real big problem. Any of you have tried to talk with one another in the speech classroom will know what I'm saying. Also, binaural processing started being exploited. Despite the fact that's what I did, I'm not going to say a word about that beyond what I just did. And finally, more effective and mature approaches to information fusion. And this is important, and of course, Hynek and his colleagues, along with Dan Ellis and Everett Ballard, actually, we're sort of at the forefront of this, looking at different ways of combining information across different classifiers, different channels, other different dimensions. And that's an important thing for auditory processing as well, because that's the way it works. So, in the remaining 12 minutes, I'm counting from when I started talking, not from 10 o'clock, so if you're wondering why the numbers don't add up. In the remaining 12 minutes, I'll talk about peripheral auditory modeling at Carnegie Mellon, more or less since 2004. Take this just as an example. There are many other people doing the same things we are, and I'll try to call attention to that when appropriate. But don't kill me if I miss miss your favorite thing. But our work, as well as others, as some of the foci include representation of synchrony, the shape of the rate intensity function, analysis duration, frequency resolution, onset enhancement, modulation filtering, a couple of higher level things which we can't even begin to think about now. One of the things that I want to talk about in terms of synchrony is a classic set of experiments from the late 1970s by Eric Young, who still lives and breathes in Baltimore, and Murray Sachs, who does too, but is not as present on the scene. This was a representation. What we're looking at is a representation of a synthetic vowel. I mean, this is just abstracted from a much larger paper, but the data are representative. And the panels are different intensities. As we go from 28 dB to 78 dB, it looks like this. This was the original signal. It was actually an artificial computer-generated thing that was periodic with pseudo formants at at the right frequencies. But and the take-home message from this curve is, as you look at this, and this is the number of spikes per second of auditory nerve fibers at different frequencies, measured from one cat. So it's a composite of auditory responses. If you think of the mean rate of response as trying to be a representation of that, it looks miserable. It changes as a function of intensity, and the spectral peaks here don't correspond to anything that's real. So, on the other hand, a second representation based on so-called average localized synchrony rate, and what this is a measure of the extent to which the response that I showed you earlier is synchronized to the fundamental, the characteristic frequency of the unit and its harmonics. Complicated thing, but the main thing, and too complicated for me to really teach, but you can read the paper, is that if you measure things that way using synchrony, not only does the representation stay the same, but you have good response that seems to follow the format structure. So synchrony may be useful, even at low frequencies. Now, we did some work in the mid-2000s using an auditory model by a physiologist, Laurel Carney, and her students. Laurel was at BU and then Syracuse, and then now she's at the University of Rochester. And Shang and also Zeleny are students of hers. And again, we use this for two reasons. One is that it had a lot of the phenomena that we wanted. It had synchrony suppression, it had synchrony, and it was a good thing to use. And the code is available on the net in C. It's slow, but we expected that based on everything I've said before. And so we would take this output here, again, which is representative of what the nerve is supposed to be doing. Again, physiologists never are guilty of making things too simple. But this is a fairly sophisticated model which has a lot of effects in it, including everything I've talked about. We would just simply take that and have two channels, one for synchrony detection and one for mean rate estimation, put them all together, apply LDA, and then use that to generate something that looked like Hepster coefficients. Now, that would give us, I'll show some example outputs from that. In each of these cases, this is the original MATLAB spectrogram. This is the resynthesized spectrogram using malfrequency Kepstle coefficients, the baseline, as I showed earlier on. And this is what the model produces. And for clean speech, this is the greasy washwater utterance, the timid dialect normalization sentence. I forget the whole thing. What was it? She carried it? I don't know. It was. You all know what it is if you a speech person. Anyway, this is the representation of it, and this is the auditory output. It's interesting, it looks a little different. The formants are pretty sharply defined, and as we go down to 20 dB SNR, the formants remain sharply defined. This is, actually this doesn't change much either. The fact that this gets kind of more filled in, that happens just because you have broader band filters. The noise is white and the filters get wider as we go up in frequency. At 10 dB though, this is again a much better representation than this, and then at 0 dB it's cruddy enough that it's not that useful. If we look at recognition accuracy results, over here this is Wall Street Journal and white noise. This is malfrequency Kepler coefficients, auditory mean rate, and synchrony. The red curve is synchrony, which doesn't make too much difference, unfortunately. This is mean rate. But we get an improvement of performance, effectively an improvement of about 7 dB what I call 7 dB of threshold shift, which is an improvement comparable to what we would get using VTS. In music, it's worse, and by the way, I got to do this curve over at some point. This is the malfrequency Kepler coefficients. This is mean rate and synchrony. Curve's mislabeled. But it gets better. Now, the question is, do the models really have to be so complex? Well, I don't know. This is the model of Zhang et al., 2001, that I quoted previously. This is a real brain damage model. You take your signal coming in, run it through a bank of bandpass filters, so-called gamma tone filters, which are part of the Slaney toolbox, and then pass it through a half-wave rectifier and then a low-pass filter. Very, very easy, even simpler than malfrequency Kepler coefficients, and then do the same processing after that. And the results are kind of one of those, is the glass half empty or half full? This is the malfrequency Kepler coefficients. This is the simple model, and this is the complicated model. So there are kind of two messages here. One is that you can really improve on malfrequency Kepler coefficients pretty quickly and easily. And by the way, Malcolm Slaney and Mike Seltzer have a paper about this at least I assume they do. I saw the thing submitted and neither told me that it got accepted, but I'm sure it did. I didn't review it, but I would have accepted it. Part of this is that MALCAPs are kind of brain damaged themselves, that there are many implementations and the standard one is not one of the better ones. But you can still do a lot better by paying more attention to things like the shape of the filter, the nonlinearity. But if you want to go whole hog and incorporate all of those various things that Carney's group includes in their representation, you'll do still better. I spent a fair amount of time trying to look at attributes of the model that were important, but I'm going to skip that because time is short. And I want to go to the last topic, which is PNCC processing, which is a new feature set that Chan Mu Kim, one of my students, developed a few years ago, and the final transactions paper is still gestating, but nevertheless, there are a lot of conference papers out there. And yes, we have code available. And in fact, it's been used widely both by BBN and IBM for RATS, and the SRI team does too. So it works at least when combined with other ingredients, including PLP. It's a pragmatic implementation of a number of the principles that we described. It uses gamma tone filters, nonlinearity shape to follow auditory processing, a longer analysis window for environmental compensation, which is helpful in some cases, enhancement of envelope onsets, which is the same feature that you would see in raster processing and in the Cohen model. Also, it's computationally efficient. So here's revisiting malfrequency Kepler coefficients on a slightly different axis. You have the initial frequency analysis, triangular frequency weighting, log nonlinearity, and then a DCT to get you back to Kepler coefficient domain. Here is short time, the same thing for PLP augmented by raster processing, which is in here. The raster filter is a bandpass filter in the Kepler domain, which has a number of spectacular properties that I've only appreciated over the decades. It provides the same kind of Kepler normalization that CMN does, but also provides modulation filtering, and also in the time domain provides contrast enhancement. All of that in one very prescient thing. The original paper, by the way, was a product of the first Rutgers workshop that Geordie Cohen organized around 1993, 94, I think was the date. 93. The very first granddaddy of all of these workshops, the first two were at Rutgers, and they were more of a focus on signal processing. And this is one of the things that came out of that proceedings. Hermansky and Morgan, which described this. Very, very useful. Then parallel nonlinearity, and then LPC-based capture. PNCC processing has a lot of the things here. Probably the biggest difference is that there's some additional things thrown in there for noise reduction, which neither PLP nor MFCC attempted to incorporate, because that wasn't on the table. It wasn't part of the original design goals. And aside from that, although the details vary, they're similar in concept. I'm just going to jump right to the results, because otherwise I'll run over time. I do want to point out one thing. Modulation filtering, which is part of mostly sophisticated algorithms now that wasn't on the charts in the early 80s. This is the envelope of speech coming out of one of the analysis filters. I forget even which one, although that one. And note that speech varies pretty rapidly because that's the way we utter things at a kind of a characteristic articulation rate. And noise is fairly constant. So just the simple artifice of doing a bandpass filtering of the Kepler coefficients as they evolve will get rid of a lot of the noise. And in fact, that's what Rasta does. And we do it a different way using something we call nonlinear filtering. But nevertheless, we have that same goal of working in the modulation spectral domain. And there's a lot of work beginning with Brian Kingsbury's thesis at ICSI that tries to address those that issue more directly. I'm just going to say the computational complexity of a PNCC processing is about twice as much as MFCC and PLP. However, there's a fix that doesn't really affect the recognition accuracy, which is just cutting off the tails of the long gamma tone filters that gets it back in the same duration. If you're, you can see the slides that I'm omitting because the talk will be posted on the conference site. I just want to say a few words about performance. This is resource management and white noise, the absolute easiest task. If you want to show good improvement, use white noise. But we see malfrequency Kepler coefficients and Rasta PLP at this level of performance. Again, they weren't intended to be working with noise. Vector Taylor series, which for a while was the industry standards. And then finally, PNCC processing is up here, which is even better than VTS. And again, much simpler to do. In Wall Street Journal, we see the same thing. The differences are a little bit less, which is typical as you increase the complexity of the task. Music is harder, but we still get improvements. And also we get a small bit of improvement in reverberation. There's a variant of these techniques that's based on enhancement of temporal contrast. And what I want to point out with that is that, and that's the so-called SSF processing. What I want to point out with that is that here we have, especially for if we look at, say, noise and music, these last two things, they're a little bit better than VTS, but not a lot better. But in reverberation, having that enhancement of temporal contrast, which is kind of a way of getting the precedence effect cheaply, and I'll talk with you guys offline on this. We have an interesting result that's coming in the fall. Having that temporal contrast really helps reverberation, and it's very easy to do. You pay a little bit of a price for clean speech, which is why it isn't in the original package. Finally, I just want to throw up some results that Chan Woo Kim got at Google, because this discussion about deep neural nets is a big thing. These are results got using the baseline Google system, whatever it is, they're not going to tell us, trained on deep neural nets in reverberant environment, plotted as a function of reverb time from 0 up to 800 milliseconds. And these are the same results, up is good, this is word accuracy, when an auditory-based model is added with special focus on temporal enhancement. And I don't know what the task is, but it's a big task. This experiment took a week to run and train. at least for this particular situation, I can't claim how well it generalizes, we're seeing still that we're getting a substantial boost in performance over the, you know, whatever the standard Google system is that they use for their experiments. We know it's a deep neural net system. So there's some hope that we can remain relevant as we continue into the second decade of the 21st century. So, what matters? Knowledge of the auditory system, I believe, can improve recognition accuracy, use of synchrony, rate intensity, onset enhancement, modulation filtering. There's a bunch of other stuff I can't talk about at all because we're out of time. PNCC processing tries to include more effective nonlinearity, parameter estimation for noise compensation that actually is pretty helpful and cheap. Also, you get noise compensation based on modulation filtering. We're only the most recent people to do that, and many of the people are right here in this room. Onset enhancement, computationally efficient representation. We haven't yet seriously considered synchrony representation in that context. Also, I remain convinced that lateral suppression should be important, and there's a lot more that we can learn. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.